5, 4, 3, 2. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. My guest this week is historian and educator Donald Miller. His new book is Vicksburg, Grant's Campaign That Broke the Confederacy. And what I love so much about this book, first and foremost, as a history buff, I love the Civil War. I think it was a turning point for this country. But more importantly, General Ulysses S. Grant, long before becoming a what you might call a superstar on the battlefield and eventually President of the United States, went through a series of changes, self-doubt, stumbling, bumbling around for a while, drinking, not really finding his niche until perhaps getting immersed in battlefields. So we'll be talking with Donald Miller for the next half hour about his new book and about the personality that is today, Ulysses S. Grant. Donald, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Al. Nice to be here.
Obviously, I mean, you more than anybody else. I mean, you're a historian, a noted historian, best-selling author. You certainly have written about the Civil War many times. Many books have been written about the Civil War. But what about Vicksburg and Grant in this particular period in American history really enthralled you?
Well, it's a turning point of the war. The Union, from the beginning of the war, is trying to gain control of the entire Mississippi Valley. And all areas roughly south of Cairo, Illinois, at the southern tip of Illinois, all the way down to New Orleans, are in Confederate hands at the beginning of the war. Slowly, the Navy begins to recapture a lot of these ports, like New Orleans and Memphis. But by late 1862, when Grant first invades Mississippi, Vicksburg and a little port just to the south of it are the only Confederate citadel cities or fortresses on the Mississippi. So they prevent farmers, for example, from the Midwest from, you know, selling their crops through New Orleans, from moving their crops out. They prevent the Union from having naval operations in the lower Mississippi Valley as well. So Grant's trying to take the last standing, you know, Confederate fortification. And when he does, eventually, one day after the surrender of Gettysburg, it splits the Confederacy in two. The states west of the Mississippi that are fighting for the Confederate cause, Arkansas, Texas, and great areas of Louisiana, are cut off from the rest of the Confederacy. And Grant captures at Vicksburg an entire army. It's the second time in the Civil War he did it. And also he fights in a way at Vicksburg that I call it a war-winning strategy, that when he's called east by Lincoln to run all American armies and to fight Robert E. Lee in Virginia, he brings that style of warfare to the east, which is a very tough, almost total warfare, where you're warring on civilian property as well as soldiers. So it becomes a kind of a people's war. Very rough, very rough.
Now, you've described, again, the heroic Ulysses S. Grant. And even I, as I said, I consider myself a history buff, but even I didn't realize that long before these campaigns and the success that he had on the battlefield, did he have a lot of self-doubt, did he not?
Vic, he wasn't ready to capture Vicksburg when he re-entered the service again just after the opening of the Civil War in April 1861. I mean, he'd been cashiered out of the Army for drinking on duty, and he was... He tried just about everything, farming, real estate, you name it, and failed at everything. And when the war breaks out, he's living in a little lead mining town called Galena in western Illinois with his family. And he's working basically as a stock boy in a hardware store or leather goods store owned by his father. It was humiliating. And he hears about his news of Fort Sumter. He tries to get into the service. He has difficulty doing that because of his past record of drinking. But just consider Grant. Here he is, a non-entity when the war begins. And that same year, he's named a brigadier general. Although he reads about it in the newspaper, he doesn't know. He had a secret sponsor back in Illinois, you know, his local congressman who needed a a brigadier general from the state of Illinois. So he's promoted from there. That's 61. And the next year, he captures Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River in Tennessee, which is the first great Union victory of the war. That's where he got the term U.S. Grant. And the next year, he captures Vicksburg. The next year, he beats, he goes and fights Lee in Virginia. And the following year, he takes Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse. And 4 years later, he's president of the United States. So from the hardware store to the White House in 8 years. And along the way, he makes mistake after mistake. And that's what I meant about, I read so many, I call it hagiography, not biography, where, you know, there's very little criticism of the author's subject. I try to present Grant warts and all. I mean, he made a lot of mistakes, and that's what I meant about him not being ready for Vicksburg. I mean, at Fort Donelson, for example, he left the battlefield without putting one of his commanders, his second in command, and the rebels attacked, and almost they were being besieged in a fort there and along the Cumberland River, and they broke out and almost cut through the Union lines and escaped. And then later on at Shiloh, which is up to that point the bloodiest battle of the Civil War, that's in Tennessee, at a place called Pittsburg Landing, he's totally unprepared there. The enemy he's attacking, the largest Confederate army at the time, is a day and a half ride away. And they're coming toward him. He doesn't know it. He gets completely surprised. And he doesn't entrench. He doesn't dig entrenchments along his front lines or prepare his frontline troops. He didn't even have cavalry scouts out. The enemy at that point was camped, you know, less than 15 minutes away, and some of his pickets and scouts are warning he and William Tecumseh Sherman, his right-hand man, that the rebels are near. They can see their campfires, and there's some shooting on the perimeter of the camps. Well, he gets surprised, and the army gets pushed back almost into the river on the first day. It was humiliating, and it could have cost Grant his command. He rallies on the second day. He gets reinforcements, and he achieves a tremendous victory. But when people count up the losses, the tremendous losses at Shiloh, he starts to get the label Butcher Grant. So in a day, he literally goes from Grant, the great hero of Donelson, into a guy who maybe isn't fit for command. And then all kinds of rumors are spreading about him drinking on the day of the battlefield. Now, Grant drank, and he drank consistently but intermittently throughout the war. He was an alcoholic, but he was a binge drinker. And he'd go for long periods without drinking, and he couldn't hold his alcohol well. So when he drank, he got out of control. But he wasn't that day. And he fought heroically, rallied his troops on the first day, he and Sherman, and performed brilliantly on the battlefield. But, geez, it was an inexcusable strategic mistake not to be prepared for the Confederates.
Yeah, I mean,
that happened a lot.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, that came out so clearly in the book. I mean, again, today, as you said, in a fairly short span of time, this guy goes from being a stock clerk in his father's business into the military, but makes so many bumbling, stumbling mistakes, as you talked about, the alcoholic on one day and then the clear-headed leader on the next day. And you find this ebb and flow that goes on through the book. Let's talk a little bit about... People will be thinking, well, who really cares? I mean, what was at stake here? But if not for Ulysses S. Grant, my sense is that, well, first of all, slavery was at its peak, was it not? I mean, the entire Southern economy depended on slavery, and it was flourishing at that time until Grant came into the picture.
Well, the entire United States economy was dependent on slavery. 40% of American exports are cotton, and cotton's produced by slaves. And Mississippi is one of the largest, next to Virginia, the slave-owning states, like Virginia and Georgia. So cotton and slavery are at the heart of this sort of thing. And when Grant goes into cotton country, when he reaches cotton country in southern Tennessee and goes into Mississippi, he's at the heart of the Confederacy. He's in the vitals of the Confederacy. And as he moves, he begins to, this is another part of the book I think that's pretty new, and it's certainly new in the terms of how much rigor I bring to it. by studying soldier letters, slave testimonies. He frees, believe it or not, over 100,000 slaves in the lower Mississippi Valley. And he puts about 26,000 of those recently freed slaves into Union uniforms, into Union blue. And they fight, African-Americans fight for the first time in the war, not at Fort Wagner, which is portrayed in the great film Glory. That was later in the summer, but at a place called Fort Milliken, which is a grant storage camp and supply camp in Louisiana. Blacks had just been trained, given their guns. Some of them only received their guns the night before. They held with the help of some Union gunboats, and they suffered horrific casualties. But Grant, in this sense, is a liberator. In fact, after he takes Vicksburg, he had a friend who was a nurse in the Union Army, who was a friend of his wife's, Annie Wittenmeyer, and she had a house that she rented in Vicksburg, and a day or two after the surrender invited Grant to dinner, and word got out in the community, and all these slaves had been liberated literally only a day or two, and they start to gather around the house when they get word that Grant's arriving, and Wittenmeyer asked him about it and says, no, your liberator is in Washington, it's Abraham Lincoln. And a couple of the slave elders said, no, no, it's, you know, our liberator's Ulysses Grant, and he's why we're free. So that's a side of Grant you don't ordinarily see.
Right.
He had almost no interest in slavery as an issue for or against when the war began. He was against the extension of slavery into territories, but was willing to allow the South to hold on to their slaves, you know, and as a way of preventing the war. But once he gets in on this thing, he jumps in, you know, full throttle and becomes, I think, Frederick Douglass. I have a quote from the great black liberator Frederick Douglass. He said, yes, it was Lincoln's proclamation, but that proclamation, the Emancipation Proclamation, had to be backed up with the sword. Slaves could only be freed by military action.
And that comes through very, very clearly, and you get the sense that, as you said, from a very early age, he didn't really have a strong sense one way or the other on slavery, but eventually turning out to be the man, as you said, who with the help of military force made all the difference in the world in freeing the slaves. You know as well as I do, especially in the. You know, with your background and as a historian, that no one leader can do it all. You need good subordinates. You need good commanders under your tutelage. In this case, and you mentioned it from the outset, William Tecumseh Sherman. Was Grant good at picking quality men as leaders, or was this just a friend who he said, we've been friends for a while now, why don't you take command of this group of soldiers?
No, he knew Grant, Sherman vaguely before the war. They were classmates at West Point, although Sherman was ahead of him, and they weren't in close contact after that, and but both ran into a lot of trouble. Sherman, too, failed at a number of enterprises. He tried banking out on the West Coast. He also tried real estate. He tried to run a railroad, a streetcar company. And they meet accidentally in St. Louis, I think it's 1859, and Grant's selling wood from his father-in-law's farm. His father-in-law had a farm near St. Louis, and he would cut wood and take it in there, and he was shabbily dressed, standing on the street corner selling wood in desperate circumstances. And Sherman said, my God, you know, what's happened here? And Grant said, well, I'm just trying to solve the problem of poverty. And Sherman said, I guess military training doesn't prepare anybody for civilian life. We're both in a funk here and unable to move. And the war saves both of them and brings out their, I don't want to say innate, but their inward qualities as leaders. And Sherman also, Grant had the drinking problem. Sherman drank, but he controlled it. And in his first serious command, he had fought at Bull Run, but then after that, in the first battle of the Civil War, but after that, when he's assigned to be the commander in Kentucky, he flips out. He has there's no other way to describe it but a nervous breakdown. He's drinking excessively. He's smoking 12 and 14 cigars a day. He's walking the halls of the hotel at night, very spooky, you know, hollowed out eyes. And some reporter spotted him and said, he's a very sick man. And he was eventually, the commander in the West named Henry Halleck, who had been a friend of his, took him under his wing and brought him back to his headquarters in St. Louis. He sobered up with the help of his wife, and he had a very supportive family. He pulls out of it. So when he first, you know, joins Grant's command, it wasn't at Grant's initiative. Halleck appointed him to assist Grant at, you know, he first appears at the Battle of Fort Donelson, and he's sending supplies to Grant. And through correspondence, they become close. And then when they go to Shiloh, they're kind of shoulder to shoulder. And from then on, for the rest of the war, they're partners in command and, in, you know, inseparable, and supported each other tremendously. Sherman used to joke after the war that when Grant was drunk, I came to his aid, and when I was crazy, Grant came to my aid.
I guess summing it up, it comes down to, you know, not all leaders, not all great leaders are necessarily born with that, you know, with that DNA. I mean, it develops.
No,
through...
you become that, and I try to dwell on the fact, not dwell on the fact, I try to, you know, point out that, I don't use the word genius when it comes to military commanders. I reserve that for people like Einstein. And these guys, and Grant especially, learned by fighting. He wasn't particularly interested in textbook theory. He was never interested in military theory at West Point. His favorite classes were math. He wanted to be after he served his term following West Point, he wanted to be a professor of mathematics in a small Midwestern college, but didn't get the appointment. Imagine if he had got that appointment, he's out of history.
Right.
And, you know, and you don't know what happens in the Civil War. I kept thinking that, too, when Grant takes these incredible risks, I mean, at Vicksburg, and at one point almost loses Sherman and Admiral Porter, David Dixon Porter, who's the naval commander down there and worked hand in glove with Grant. He almost loses Porter, Sherman, and four or five of the Union ironclad gunboats he needed to capture Vicksburg by going into the Delta, this swampy area that extends from just north of Vicksburg almost to Memphis, and an area where Union military scouts had said was impenetrable by a Navy or an Army. He sends Porter in there. Porter's on his own. He went in on his own because you can't order around an admiral. A general can't order around an admiral. They cooperated because they liked one another and they believed in each other's ideas about military strategy. But Lincoln thought, you know, get him out of that swamp.
Yeah.
Get him back onto the Mississippi. They were ambushed in the swamp, and rebels were about to board. The gunboats were stuck. They were stuck in willows that were there at the bottom of this very narrow, almost canal-like stream in the swamp. And rebels were about to board the gunboats, and Porter was going to blow them up. He handed out rifles to his men. He had them smear mud all over the gunboats so the sides of the gunboats would be slippery and it would be tough for boarding parties to get on. And he said, look, if we're losing this hand-to-hand fighting, we're going to escape to the woods if we can, and I'm going to blow up the gunboats. And Sherman, who was behind him by about 10 to 12 miles, just coming up with more troops, he couldn't get through because his troop transports were too big, too high, and the chimneys were so high that they were blown off, you know, actually by the overhanging trees. And they, you know, he also ran into obstructions in the river. So he takes his men off the boats, and he does an all-night march. The guys stick candles in their rifles, light the candles, and that's the only way they could see through these swamps. And they're walking through water up to their waist and sometimes up to their necks. They get there in time, and they save Porter. And Porter he can't even turn around. The stream's so narrow, he has to back out. And at that point, we're in late March and of 1863, and it looks to me, and to most of the American public at the time, I kept scratching my head when I was writing this section. Why wasn't he removed?
Yeah.
He had made so many mistakes.
Exactly.
And he was no closer to taking Vicksburg than he was back when he started in November and December of 62.
Let me want to take a quick pause and come back and talk a little bit about, as you said, most people would think, remove this guy. But we're going to take a quick pause to let people know that they're listening to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vohner, and this is The Public Eye. My guest this week is best-selling author and historian Donald Miller. His new book is Vicksburg, Grant's Campaign That Broke the Confederacy. And as Don's been talking about this evening, what did President Abraham Lincoln see in Ulysses S. Grant, initially a stumbling, bumbling, basically down-and-out drunk, who rallied Union troops to become successful, win the Civil War, and eventually become president of the United States. Don, let me ask you, so with that said, was Lincoln sitting there in the White House going, what am I, why do I have this guy in charge? Or did he have some sense that this man was going to pull it off?
Well, luckily for Grant, Lincoln's other commanders were so horrible in the West, the commanders he had in the West. He had problems in the East, too, with George McClellan.
Oh, yeah.
And Grant had won victories out there. As I mentioned, he wins Donelson, although it's a bloodbath. He wins Shiloh, and he's penetrated into Mississippi. And Grant doesn't have anybody around him that, in the White House that's unalterably supporting him. There are doubters, especially after Shiloh when he makes the mistakes. But who else do we have? And I think Lincoln appreciated Grant's resolve, his punchback capabilities, his determination. One of the Union officers pointed out that Grant had a look on his face like he was going to drive his head through a brick wall. And he had that kind of snapback attitude on things. He'd suffer a loss, and it didn't. I know it bothered him, but it didn't seem to bother him, even in his letters to his wife. There's some doubt there, but he always believed in himself. I think, too, the fact that he's fighting alcoholism and largely winning, and it's not a crippling deficiency at this point. It's kind of an intermittent thing. That, I think, helps, too. And he also had, and Lincoln saw this vision, he realized after Shiloh, that this war wasn't going to be fought with the gloves on. The Confederacy wasn't going to come back into the Union. They had to be crushed. They had to be reduced to powder. And so lives would have to be, put on the line and lost in great numbers, that the battles were going to be tremendous. And as his friend Sherman said, wars don't wind down. Wars generally get worse, especially wars for national survival. And both sides are fighting wars for national survival, the survival of the Confederate States and the survival of the United States of America. And Grant saw that very early on, and also saw, as Lincoln began to see, that maybe we can't win this thing unless we begin recruiting black troops. Because he was, rubbing the bottom of the barrel in terms of, the number of troops he had available to him, even after he instituted a military draft. You could institute a military draft then, but you'd only pick up about 20-25% of the draftees. You
right.
Simply avoid the draft.
Let me ask you, what was Lincoln's view on recruiting black soldiers? Was he on board with that?
He was very strong on it. Not at the beginning of the war. There's a clause in the Emancipation Proclamation, which is officially goes into effect on Jan 1, 1863. That's, again, the importance of Vicksburg. Just as Grant's at Vicksburg, this goes into effect. And I think Lincoln saw that when, independent of the number of troops that are recruited, they're important. Lincoln wanted them to be put on garrison duty, not necessarily to be on the front lines, but to be protecting forts along the river and holding places that the Union took. But he also saw that for every slave we take from the South, we hurt the South. And boys that are fighting in Virginia, for example, might have to go home to Mississippi if their slaves run away to Grant's army, there's no one to work the fields, you know, to put in the cotton crop, to put in the corn crop. And slaves did all the work on Confederate fortifications. They cooked meals for the Confederate soldiers. They did, you know, enormous amount of what we would call garrison duty, grub duty. And so, you know, even soldiers bought into this idea. Soldiers who came from Midwestern families, boys who volunteered to save the Union, not to free slaves. And they were reluctant, and there was a lot of dissension in the camps after the proclamation was issued. And there's a lot of desertion from Grant's army. Boys simply go home and say, I didn't enlist to try to free slaves. I enlisted to save the Union.
Right.
But slowly these guys begin to see that in hurting slavery and taking slaves, they're causing irreparable, and it is irreparable damage to the Southern economy. Cotton was a commodity that was grown in the fields and sold to buy munitions for, you know, cannons and rifles for the Confederate Army. And the guys begin to see that. And you have kids that you would call today almost racist in their attitudes toward black people,
right?
But yet they're anti-slavery.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The book is multifaceted. I think, you know, most people think of a book on U.S. history, whether it's World War II, the First World War, Korean War, Civil War. You know, that there's a set pattern here, but as you describe it this evening, emotions on both sides. What did I fight for? What am I fighting for? No, I'm not going to fight for freeing slaves, but yet slaves become an intricate part of the success of the Union Army. I got a bumbling, stumbling leader who gets drunk sometimes. You know, he doesn't seem to know what he's doing, but then he wins major battles. The dynamics were just absolutely tremendous. I get the sense that you personally, and I know you've studied a lot of famous people through history during your career, but did Ulysses S. Grant hold something special for you personally?
He's the best commander I've ever encountered. He's on par with Hannibal. He's on par with Napoleon. He's on par with Julius Caesar. He's that good. He's not only good on the battlefield, but he had been a quartermaster in the Mexican War, and a good one. And he knew a lot about logistics. And in the end, this becomes an effort when it turns into a siege at Vicksburg in May, June, the first days of July, 47-day siege. He has to build a tremendous supply line back to the north, you know, to supply his, 50,000 and eventually 70,000 troops, and he does that very effectively. Also, when he goes into Mississippi, below Vicksburg eventually, marching his army south, I don't have a map in front of me here, and you don't have a map, your listeners don't have a map, but his camps were across the river from Vicksburg in Louisiana, and the area below his camps were flooded, and the waters began to recede in late March, just as Grant pulls out of that swamp. And at that point, Lincoln was so dubious about Grant that he sends a spy into Grant's camps, a guy named Charles Dana, who has worked for the War Department, and he quickly becomes a Grant ally. And anyway, Grant marches his army all the way south and then Vicksburg through this swamp. The water's receding slowly. The roads are at the top of the levees. It takes a month to do that, and then crosses the river and marches on Vicksburg. Then that Lincoln starts to really believe in him.
Yeah.
When he sees how quickly he's marching through Mississippi, and he wins in a matter of a month, five battles, and entraps the Confederate Army inside Vicksburg. And then it becomes a question of starving them out. But even when he goes into Mississippi for the first time, he has no maps, hardly any cavalry, and he's short on supplies. And there's a theory that he lived entirely off the land, but he didn't. There's another thing I found in the record. It's the value of going into the archives. I went into 51 archives for this book. And what you find is he built this long supply line back to Louisiana. and he'd bring in supplies, wagon loads of supplies, on steamboats across the Mississippi, and they'd catch up with his army. As many as 200 of them a day arriving in his army train as they marched on Vicksburg. Eventually, he cuts away from that supply line because it gets too long, but he had a long supply line at the beginning. So he's thinking ahead all the time.
Yeah.
Vision.
Exactly. Vision. And that's what I came away with, too, that this man, reached into the depths of his soul and with the help of innate abilities, one being that, as you said, that vision and that.
Yeah, when you're reading this thing, when I'm writing this thing, I'm slapping my editor said the same thing. He said, Simon and Schuster, he said, Tom, he said, why wasn't he removed?
Yeah.
He said, nobody today could have survived.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you say, not again. And think about it. If Grant and Sherman and perhaps even Porter had been removed, I mean, these are the three commanders that, along with Lincoln, bring about the Union victory.
Yeah.
I don't know if we could have won the Civil War without them.
I have to agree with you. It's just incredible, and I don't think people really realize that. That's why I would urge people, especially people who are history buffs and want to know how this country came to be, and I think it's always so important. Vicksburg, Grant's Campaign That Broke the Confederacy is the new book by Donald Miller. Don, people obviously may want to post questions, find out more about your research and what you've been up to. How might they reach you?
Well, they can write to me. I have a website, SITES, at Lafayette College, EDU, and there's a box in there. If you have a question, just, put it together, and I answer all my mail. I get a lot of mail on my books, and I write back to everybody.
Yeah,
I believe in my readership. You know, if people are passionate enough and concerned enough to write, and usually they write very intelligent questions. And these aren't all by military experts.
No, just average citizens.
I'm trying to write a book that's almost like a novel.
Yeah,
intrigue. It has movement. It has outstanding characters. And I try to move it along like a running locomotive. I believe in momentum because Grant used the word celerity, movement, quickness all the time, and I try to bring that to the prose.
Well, as someone who tries to be, I guess, sound like a critic, a book critic, I can tell you that the Vicksburg is not a dry book at all. It is not just dates and episodes. It is really about personalities, the development of human nature, the depths of mankind, and how they reach down at the lowest point of life, only to become, even more successful because of that innate ability, as Donald has been talking about tonight. Again, the book is Vicksburg, Grant's Campaign That Broke the Confederacy. My guest has been a best-selling author and noted historian Donald Miller. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. Pose any questions, comments, or feedback to me directly. Certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, VUONA, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.